We have a member of parliament, Tony Benn. Have any of you heard of Tony Benn? Yes. Okay. He's a bit of, he has been a little bit of a radical. Has he died?
Yeah, he died.
He did. A few months ago. And he said this: I came out of politics to give more time to politics. Came out of politics to give more time to politics. And what he meant was, when you're in politics, you're so consumed with politics, you can't stand back and take a wider picture. For those of you who have done science at a higher level, you'll know that if this is the tree of knowledge, okay, when you do a PhD, you're not climbing on a branch, you end up on one little twig of the tree. Okay? Not on a not even a twig, one leaf. Is that right? So you end up spending 3-5 years researching one tiny little leaf on the great tree of knowledge. Not only that, very often you find, if you then go on to do a career in science, many scientists stay on one tiny little branch. And they sometimes stay on one little leaf. And they never climb out of the tree and stand back. And if that's the tree of physics, and there are lots of different trees in this orchard of knowledge, they never spend time, because it's such a pressured life, looking at science overall, the overall picture of science. At least in England, there is a really big fault in all of our science teaching and all of our education. We never study the history of science. So if you do science at A level and then degree level and higher, you never study the history of science. So you never stand back from your field and say, well, what's happened over the last 100 years in science? What's happened? And so you think that your science of your day is absolute, but you never stand back to gain a perspective which helps you to see that actually everything changes. Everything changes. I think of two massive theories in the last century. The Big Bang Theory, we used to think of the steady state theory, the universe is eternal and unchanging, Fred Hoyle and those kind of guys, and then the Big Bang Theory broke that paradigm. The structure of the earth, now we believe in plate tectonics, before that it was more like a cooling ball, and the surface was like an apple as it dried, and the mountain ridges were like those, you know, as the apple dries, the skin of an apple. Radically changed with plate tectonics. So when you stand back from science, you actually get a better perspective. I would say this. I've been out of science for 25 years. I would say I understand science. I don't mean this in any proud way. I don't mean this in any proud way whatsoever. Far better today than I ever did in the 10 years I was within it. Because I was up in the tree, climbing around one tiny branch on one little leaf, and I never came down out of the tree and stood and had a look around. And so I think that's true of many good science friends of mine. And in the West, at least, I'm going to be talking from the UK situation. So what I'm saying, you may have to ask questions at the end. There is a myth in the UK that says that there is something antagonistic between science and Christianity. There is that feeling. It's entered popular culture. Some people will say science and Christianity are opposites, absolute opposites. Science deals with solid, provable facts. Christianity deals with unprovable, unknowable truths, beliefs, shall I say. Science is advancing all the time, but Christianity is just about the past, and it's stationary and unchanging. So either they're very different from each other. Sometimes the view is that they're enemies, and there's warfare between the two. I meant to just say one of the things my church is very good at doing, they release me to spend time reading, talking. I think I mentioned this on the other night, on this subject. And one day I hope to write on it, but I told you I'm not going to write yet. One day that time will come. Okay, so in the West, where we are in the UK, Christianity and science, they're either opposites or they're enemies, and there's warfare between the two. This is the cultural myth that enters our UK culture and probably is picked up through television programs, internet. So if you talk to someone on the street, Mr. Average Joe blogs, he would say, oh no, science and Christianity are opposed. And I've met that when people say to me, are you a scientist and a pastor? I see their eyes light up and they say, you can't be. You can't possibly be a pastor and a scientist. Now, some of the jokes are not going to carry across. There are going to be some English jokes, and my good friend has tried his best to translate them, haven't you? But we'll see how those work. Very often scientists make fun of Christianity. This, can you read this one? So this is in Stephen Hawking's book, and it's just trying to say that when Christians talk, it's all hot air. Okay, can you see that? Here are two bishops talking in a church building. If we've learned one thing in my long reign, says the Pope, it's that heat rises. I'm talking hot air and it rises. It's meant to be just a joke that when priests and pastors and preachers talk, it's all hot air. It's meaningless. Now, I want to show you three things this evening, this afternoon. I want to try and show you where the myth comes from. Now, that's a very strong word, the myth that Christianity and science are enemies. But, you know, there are many myths that enter a culture. A myth is a view that's widely held, and yet, when you explore it, it turns out to be false. I'm going to show you, first of all, where the myth has come from, and I'm thinking of the UK situation, why the myth is false, and then I'm going to try to explain why Christianity and science are good friends. They're not enemies, they're good friends. Very often when I give this talk, it's evangelistic. Peter asked me, do you need your Bible for this talk? And the thing is, most times I give this talk, at least half the people are not Christians, and they have been brought by Christians. So that's why I'm not opening my Bible. It's not because, not for any other reason, okay? Okay, that's my first joke, and it doesn't work, does it? I put that joke on just to say, turn your cell phone off. But, I mean, you don't have to do that, but if you're giving a talk, it's just my prompt to... Okay, so what is science? You all know this. It starts with data, starts with rocks, fossils... data that you gather from the natural world, galaxies, data about planets, stars, and then you try to correlate that together. The human mind is very unhappy with 1,000 facts all lying round the floor. Our human minds want to integrate them. How do they connect together? How do those fossils connect together? How do all those planetary systems connect together? How do the stars connect together? And so, human minds just want to develop some sort of theory, and then you go back into the lab and you test it out, and very often you have to come back and modify your model, and round you go. Now, this is important to understand what science is not, because I find there's a confusion in at least three areas. Science is not the same as technology. Technology is making paper, making gunpowder, it's building pyramids, it's learning how to use metals, and that is not the same as science. This is an important distinction you'll see in a moment, because you can do all of that and never ask the probing questions which allow you to build up knowledge which leads to science. You can have technology in a culture and have absolutely no science whatsoever. Secondly, science is not the same as scientism. Scientism says that the only way to find truth is through science. And there is nothing whatsoever in science itself. There are scientists who believe in scientism, that the only way you can discover anything that is truthful is through the scientific method, but there's nothing in science itself which would say this is the only method you can find truth. It's a metaphysical bolt-on. Does that translate into German? Metaphysical? What would metaphysical be? Meta is beyond.
That's direct.
Oh, I'm impressed. It's a metaphysical bolt-on to the enterprise of science. Thirdly, science is not the same as naturalism. Naturalism says there is no such thing as a god. There's no such thing as angels, demons. There's no such thing as an invisible world. And all there is what you can touch, see, deduce with your mind. And again, it's a philosophical bolt-on. It's no part of science. Science, by its very nature, leaves many things open. It's a spirit of inquiry. It's prepared to say, well, I'm not sure. I can't explain this in this way. I wonder if there's another way to explain it. And then there's Christianity, and hopefully by the end of Romans, you know what that is. So if you were to draw to a Venn, do you remember Venn diagrams at school? Yeah, do you remember a Venn diagram? So you've got a circle here, and this is Christianity. You've got a circle here, science. To be honest, the overlap is fairly small. Yes, keep waving at me. I'll come back here. The overlap is relatively small between Christianity and science. And sometimes I wonder how on earth there are areas, and probably you'll question me about those at the end, but science is looking at one tiny slice of reality. And we live in a much richer world than is encompassed by that narrow slice of reality. So let me start by asking, where did the myth come from? Well, it came from three sources, at least in the UK and the US. I don't know if this is true over here. Have any of you come across these books? They're old books. I have them on my shelves. John Draper and Andrew Dixon White. And if you look at the title tells you, you know what they say, don't judge a book by the cover. Well, that's wrong. These are books you can judge by their cover. So these books came out over 100 years ago. History of the conflict. It assumes there is a conflict between religion and science. The second source of this, oh dear. No, I thought that was a joke, but it isn't. The second source of this myth is there are a few classical conflicts historically, which at least in the UK are brought up as examples that science and Christianity are at loggerheads. Have you all heard of the Galileo one? You must have heard of at least that one. So Galileo says the earth is going round the sun, and the church says no, the sun is standing still, and I got that the wrong way round. Galileo says the earth is going round the sun, yes. And the church says, no, the earth is standing still and the sun is going round the earth. And so he was tried, he was put under house arrest, and everybody says, fantastic example, church and science and Christianity clash. The second one in England was between these two guys. Have you heard of this one? Thomas Huxley? Thomas Huxley was Darwin's bulldog. He supported Darwin really strongly. And Darwin was a little bit of a shy guy. Thomas Huxley was anything but a shy guy. So he took on Darwin's case and fought it in the public arena. And he took on Samuel Wilberforce in a very famous debate. A bust up in June 1860. Wilberforce, I think, foolishly said a few things that insulted Huxley. And that's another classical debate. Have you heard of this one, the Scopes trial?
It isn't William Wilberforce.
Oh, it's not William Wilberforce, the guy who freed the slaves. This is another one. It's a Samuel Wilberforce, not William. Yes, good point, Martin. Here's the third one in America. John Scopes was tried and for teaching the theory of evolution in school in the States. And there was a Butler Act which said you weren't allowed to teach, I'll read it to you, any theory that denies the story of divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man has descended from a lower order of animals. So it's a classic case. The church is forcing kids to learn against science. So these are very, very rare, but those three are taken up as classic examples of historical examples. The third source of this myth is, bringing it right up to date, these four men. Do you recognize these men? No? Do you recognize these men? Some of them? That you must recognize him. Who is he? Who is he?
Harris.
Sam Harris. This is an English man. He's died of... This is Christopher Hitchens. Daniel Dennett. Okay, so these are called the Four Horsemen. And they are the new atheists, and they have really taken up this issue. And they preach that science and Christianity are at loggerheads. So these are the three ways in which this myth is being spread about in UK culture, ends up in television programs, filters down to the man on the street. If you stop someone in Worcester and said, what do you think the relationship between Christianity and science is? My guess is most would say they are opposites. Why is the myth... Oh, that's my first joke. That's another joke. No, second joke. This only PhD students will understand this. No, that's not true. So there you are. This is a physics student. What did I say? So there's the data you see, and students are always looking for nice straight lines. But your supervisor saw a different shape, and in point of fact, it's just noise. It has no meaning at all. But we all can be prejudiced. And if you've never worked in research and never worked in science, you might think that scientists are these clinical, cold, white-coated, totally objective people. Total myth. They're ordinary humans who can skew data, who can make mistakes, who have prejudices and biases like everybody else. Is that true for those of you who are scientists?
Yes.
Amen. Okay. So the conflict thesis. Oh, I have here a quote by Paul Simon. Do you remember that? A man sees what he wants to see. How does it end? And disregards the rest. Have you come across that song? Paul Simon? Simon and Garfunkel, do you remember them? No? Okay, they were kind of the Beatles. Oh, good. What years? They were kind of the Beatles years, weren't they? Post-Beatles years?
70s.
Later, 70s. 70s. Simon and Garfunkel. A man's, I can hear the tune in my, I'm not going to sing it. Can you sing it? No.
Of course.
A man hears what he wants to hear, and he disregards the rest. We're all prejudiced creatures. Okay. Let me give you three reasons why this myth is totally wrong, that there is a conflict between Christianity and science. It's very interesting that all the great living historians of science now say it's all dead. Here are two of the greatest ones living today, Lindbergh and Numbers. They're both very top of their game and written numerous, numerous books. Historical study does not reveal science and Christianity in deadly combat. Page 5, when science and Christianity meet. Instead, they say, the relationship between science and Christianity proves to be much more intricate, I'm quoting, and intricate and interesting, with the same complexity we find in every other area of human experience. Whenever you've got people together, you end up with relationships and you end up with stress and disagreements and so on. When you do a general survey of the relationship between science and Christianity, you do not come across conflict. You find an odd little bit of juicy conflict, but by and large you don't. It's interesting, in the 10 years I was in science, I can't remember ever in a staff room or anywhere coming across. So that's thermodynamics and that's physics. I never remember any area of conflict in my studies between Christianity and science. I remember reading The Double Helix by James Watson and Francis Crick. So it's their story of how that helix was developed and discovered. And you know what really amazed me about that book was how much fighting and squabbling there was between those two teams of scientists. So you had the English team and the American team. And I remember this one example, Linus Pauling. He was working the other side of the Atlantic, and he was racing to find out the structure of DNA before the English team. And the English team found out that Linus Pauling had made a big mistake. So they all went down to the pub to toast his failure. So do scientists agree with each other, and do they support one another? No, they're human beings, and they fight just like... So I could come up with a really big thesis, science versus science conflict thesis. But of course I wouldn't, because I know that's human beings. Human beings fall out with one another. Okay? The real stories, here's the second reason why the myth is wrong. The real stories of individual conflicts turn out to be extremely different from the popular versions of those same stories. So the popular version is Galileo versus the church battle. Read all the details, nothing of the sort. Shall I give you an example? That Galileo one. He remained a devout Catholic for the whole of his life. So if there was a debate, if there was warfare here, it was between a Catholic and a Catholic. It wasn't between science and Catholicism. It was between Catholic and Catholic. He didn't stop being a Catholic. He was always a Catholic. Secondly, and this is one of the biggest lessons to learn, the church very foolishly took on Aristotelian science. This is a really big major lesson for all Christians today. Do not buy into the big stories of today's science. Because if they change in the next generation, you will sow trouble for your future, the future Christians who come after you. Never buy into the big stories of contemporary science. I don't buy into evolutionary theory. I do not buy into the Big Bang theory. I look at them and I think about them, I would never buy into the big stories, the big paradigms of Western science. Okay? The church bought into Aristotelian science. And Aristotelian science taught that the earth was the center, borrowed from Eudoxus, surrounded by seven crystalline spheres. And the church said, this is right, this is the science that is right, this is the science that it's right. And as Galileo was doing his work, he was undermining Aristotelian science. So Aristotelian science says that everything above the moon is perfect. The moon and above that is all perfect. At the earth is imperfect. And then beyond the earth, at the level of the moon and above, everything becomes perfect. Everything is imperfect below. And he began looking at the moon in his telescope and seeing spots on it. And I can't believe this, but he actually looked at the sun and saw sunspots. How did he do that? He looked at the sun in his telescope and he saw craters on the moon, imperfections. It's all meant to be perfect. He saw sunspots, imperfections. And he said this science that the church has bought into is wrong. So if there's any conflict, it is between old science and new science, not science and Christianity. If there's a big mistake the church made, if you want to call it the church, it is the church bought into the science of the day. Here's the third mistake. I'm afraid Galileo was Mr. Tactless. I've got his book at home, Dialogue Concerning Two Chief World Systems. And the two world systems are the sun at the middle, with the earth going round, and the earth at the middle, with the sun going round. And so he discusses these two great world systems, and he has three characters. Salviati is himself. Sagredo is an open-minded person, and Simplicio is the person who believes in the science of Aristotle, which included the Pope. Now, does the title Simplicio translate into German as simpleton? Does it? That's what it means. I don't know about you, I don't think it's wise in a book to call the Pope a simpleton. Not in those days. So actually, he wasn't particularly tactless in the way he went about things. So, on the surface, it looks as if science versus, it's a battle between science and Christianity, but actually it's nothing at all of the sort. This is a great book. I don't know if it's been translated into German, but it's a great book which goes through all these myths. And it is written by the top, the Ronalds, the Numbers, and the great guys of the history of science today. That's a great read. Here's the third reason why this myth is wrong and false, because the writers, the modern writers, are introducing this myth to support their anti-God agenda. So the new atheists, those four horsemen, are using this as one arsenal in their armory against Christianity. So they're not using this myth because it's true. They're using it because it helps their case. If this book works, says Richard Dawkins in his introduction, as I intend, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down. So he's got a political agenda. He wants to turn everyone who reads this book into an atheist. And so he has all these arguments. And one of them he pulls off the shelf is science, is that Christianity is so opposed to science. Okay, so there's no substance behind the myth. That one does not translate, does it? Does somebody get that one? Someone laughed. Okay. Before you can ask me questions, let me give you three reasons why Christianity and science are very good friends. So I'm ending now on a positive note. First of all, I don't know if you're aware of this, but Christianity provided science with the right soil to flourish. Have you ever wondered why science developed in Christian Europe and not in India or not in Africa or not in China? Why did it develop in Christian Europe? And there are many historians of science who say that actually it required a biblical view of the world to spur science on. So I remind you here that science is not the same as technology. A culture can make gunpowder, pyramids, movable type paper, observe the positions of the stars and planets, and not have science, because there's no curiosity, no experimentation, no building theories, no testing, no step-by-step advancement. So the Chinese had a lot of technology. For example, fireworks. But you know what? They never asked the question, what's the trajectory of that rocket as it crosses the sky? So you can have technology and yet not have an inquiring spirit which takes which goes a step further and builds what we call science. In order for science to develop, it needed at least four ingredients from the Bible, a Christian worldview. The first is that the universe is not divine. Many global cultures are pantheistic. This is God, matter, or at least God lives in matter. Now, if what we see around us is either God or God lives in it, what chance have you got of discovering it? You are human and small, and this is God. It's much greater than you. You're never going to discover anything. In fact, it might be quite dangerous. It might be blasphemy to fiddle around with nature if it is God. What does the Bible say? God created the heavens and the earth, and God is separate from them. So you can poke your fingers round in nature and learn all about it, and you're not committing the sin of blasphemy, because creation is separate from God. Secondly, this is an interesting one. Time runs from past to present to future. Now, this is really important for science. The Bible teaches that God created the heavens and the earth, and then History moves on linearly, and there's a great day of judgment. There's a beginning, and there's an end to the history of the world. Many pagan cultures have a cyclical view of time. It goes round in circles. The earth comes round to where it was before. And past and present and future get all jumbled up in pagan cultures. They suffer from time dyslexia. Yeah? Tense dyslexia. Past, present, future. For us, we'll do this the right way for you. Past, present, future. But in some cultures, they all get mixed up. Time, tense, dyslexia. I'll give you an example of that. There's an example of a Chinese king. Just before he died, he decided that human beings would be sacrificed at his funeral. And so all this happened. And you know what people said afterwards? The reason his reign was a failure was because he had people, human beings, sacrificed at his funeral. And I just want you to think about that. How can a future event, he sacrifices humans at his funeral, affect his reign backwards in time? Are you with me? How come the past is affected by a future event? Can you see that? But it made perfect sense. Past, present, future, all jumbled up. Now, you simply cannot do science like that. You start off and you do an experiment and it has an effect in the future. And then and time works linearly in that way. I've got a joke here, but this probably won't work at all in German. This is from a dyslexic scientist. What does DNA stand for? The National Dyslexia Association. That is from a dyslexic scientist, so I'm not being unkind. Okay, here's the third thing that the Bible gave to science, the third nutrient in the soil of science. The universe can be understood. When I need a motive to do science, I need to know that maybe I'll be able to discover something. And Christianity gave a great motive in this sense, that I'm made in the image of God, so I'm a little bit like God. The same God who created the universe created me, and there's a similarity between the way I think and the way he thinks. And so there's a possibility of me as a human being understanding the way he thinks and the way he created the universe. So maybe I can speak a similar kind of language to God who created the universe. And that language, by and large, is maths. The language of the universe is mathematical. Paul Dirac said, God is a mathematician of a very high order, and he used advanced maths in constructing the universe. So there's a hope of me being able to understand it, because I'm made in the image of God, and that same God created the world around me, and perhaps I'll be able to understand it for that reason. The fourth ingredient is that the universe is governed by laws. Follows on from that. Laws that never change. So if I drop a stone today, it falls in the same way as it will do tomorrow. If I throw an arrow in Leipzig, it'll follow the same trajectory as it does in Worcester. Now, if you don't have those universal laws, you can't test, you can't come back to things, you have no hope of discovering, of repeating experiments and discovering faithfulness, faithful reproduction of experiments. The Bible gave this great hope because it taught that God is a sovereign ruler of the universe, and he himself is orderly, and he's faithful, and he's dependable. Robert Boyle, God is the author of the universe and the free establisher of the laws of motion. That's technology, not science. So Christianity gave to science every encouragement, and that's what friends do. Let me quote to you from Stanley Jackie. I hope some of these words are translatable. Great cultures where scientific enterprise came to a standstill invariably failed to properly formulate physical laws. These cultures had theologies with no belief in a personal, rational, absolutely transcendent lawgiver or creator. Their cosmologies reflected pantheistic and animistic views of nature and a cyclical view of time that caught them in a treadmill of perennial inexorable returns. Stanley Jackie, written a great book, professor's written a great book of how Christianity, a biblical worldview, influenced the rising of Christianity. Second reason they're good friends is because all the great founders of science were theists. Now, I didn't have Kepler in there, and so I felt I had to include him in my diagram. You're a good German scientist. Is that right? John Kepler is a German?
Austrian.
Oh, the Austrian. Okay, see, I put him in there. He's kind of above there, Galileo. I just stuck him in. I thought, all right, okay. So all these guys, not all of them are Christian, but they're all theists. Many of them are Christians. And many of them did their work for the glory of God. That was their motive.
Technically, we know what a theist is.
Christian. Okay. A theist is someone who believes in God. Not necessarily a Christian, but who believes in God. So Isaac Newton was at least a theist. Not 100% sure if he was a Christian, but at least a theist. And all these founders of, the original founders of science were Christians, at least theists, who saw, many of them, that their work was actually intended to glorify God and reveal his glory to the world. That shouldn't surprise us, given what I've said about a biblical view of nature being required for science. So Copernicus, so great is the divine handiwork of the most excellent and greatest one, capital O. The most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. This being governs all things, not as the soul of the world, not pantheistically, but over as the Lord of all, Isaac Newton. That continues today. A poll of, I don't know what this is like in Germany, but of American scientists, gave 40% of scientists in America believe there is a God who answers prayer. Again, that doesn't necessarily mean they're Christians, but they believe in a God who answers prayer. Do you recognize some of these guys up there? They're more English. You all recognize him. Do you recognize him? John Lennox, mathematician at Oxford.
He speaks German, so he does talks here.
Oh, does he? Oh, does he? Right. I'm not at all surprised. This is Gingrich. He's an astronomer. These are top flight. Francis Collins, what did he do? He decoded the genetic code. He was part of that team. And this guy here is John Polkinghorne. These are all very high flight scientists. So it continues today that there are tons and tons of scientists at the very top of their game who are Christians in their own. Does that one work? Okay. Great. Okay. Here's the third one. Fine-tuning makes sense if there was a God who carefully designed the universe. I often give talks, and the whole talk is just on this subject. Fine-tuning is something that's really been explored and discovered in the last 30 or 40 years more and more. It's the fact that so many factors all come together for us to be here today. I mean, you and I just simply do not realize how amazing this is. We're sitting here. We're not sitting. Has anyone come across Mars One? Do you know what Mars is? Mars One is? In a few years, some people are volunteering to go to Mars, never to come back again. Okay? They're never going to come back again. And thousands have put their hands up and said, can we go to Mars? So you should see the capsules. So, you know, they're all protected from the rays because the atmosphere of Mars is too thin, and dangerous rays from the sun would kill you. And, of course, they need to have oxygen in there. And you and I forget we're just standing here on this planet and we're alive. Most places in the universe are incredibly dangerous for life. And what we've discovered in the last 30, 40 years of just how many things have to come together. Many things have to come together in order for us to be sitting here on this beautiful summer's day and not to have a spacesuit on us and not to be worried about radiation and not having enough to breathe. I'll just give you one tiny example of fine-tuning. Okay. This is one thing that's been discovered. This is in the area of physics. So in nature, people have been asking in the last 40 years, how come there are these constants in physics? And these are just numbers, and they just happen to have a particular value. So there's the mass of an electron, there's the gravitational constant here, constants for the weak force, strong force. And the question is, how come these numbers have their particular value? So gravity, which keeps us to the Earth, has this value here, 6.673. Why isn't it 6.8? Why isn't it 5.2? And more interestingly, what if it was changed from 6.673 to 6.4? Okay, so you have all these constants. So I've just built myself a universe-making machine down there, and I've just put five of those numbers in. And here's the question. If I tweak the dial a little bit on those numbers, there could be no life, or you'd have a sterile universe. And what's discovered in recent years is just how incredibly fine-tuned those numbers are. You can't mess with them a lot. You can't turn them a long way, and before you just end up with no life at all. And how come all the numbers are tweaked at the right value so that we have life? The universe is like this. It's like a clock in which if you mess with any of those parameters, I'm going to make the cog just a little bit bigger. Won't work. I'm going to put 10 more teeth on. I'm going to alter something on there. And what you discover is a clock that doesn't work. It's finely tuned. All these parameters are finely tuned. They all have to come together very closely in order for the clock to work, in order for us to be sitting here without spacesuits on. And Fred Hoyle is not a Christian. I've completely forgotten I haven't brought his quote with me, but he said, it looks as if some divine being has monkeyed with all the numbers. He uses a quote like that. Some great being has controlled all the numbers. And that's the most logical explanation, that all these factors all come together, and the reason they all come together is a great God, a great designer, turns the dials of that machine just to the right place so that you and I might be alive here today. Right, I think my last one is a question mark. Oh no, one more joke.
You hopefully pointed out at the beginning that science is not, well, technology certainly, but it's also not naturalism, it's not scientism.
Yeah.
And yet, it seems like everyone thinks it is.
Yeah.
And we've sort of lost the debate on that.
Yeah.
So how do you think Christians can effectively engage with the world in order to share the difference?
Really, science is hard to define. Not hard to define, but it's defined by... There's no such thing as science. There are scientists, aren't there? And there's this scientific method by which you... build science. I think it requires us questioning the people like Richard Dawkins and asking them why they bolt onto science these metaphysical ideas. I think that's where, I think it's saying how you distinguish. Let me give you an example. I had the picture there earlier and I crossed it off. So my PhD, I had a rig. I had an experimental rig. Okay, so just for argument's sake, I had this box. Just leave it like that. And I had probes coming in, and it was all connected to a computer, and I was evaluating something. Now, normally, I wouldn't assume that there would be an angel or a demon inside there. Okay, the scientific method just assumes, rightly so, that things progress as in as the laws of physics and science work. I wouldn't have expected any strange things going on. If I'd found, however, something going on inside there that was completely and totally inexplicable, okay, by the present laws of science, it would have been very wrong of me not to postulate other possible explanations for it. Okay? Science, by its nature, should be free to explore possibilities. So, I think of a cell, which is a suite of chemical factories, which reproduces itself. As a professor described it to us a few years ago. And I think, how could a cell have just the very first cell, say, not, let alone any other cell, ever have started? It is so massively complicated. And I would point your direction to Stephen Meyer's book on the cell. Have you come across Stephen Meyer's book on the cell? Signature in the Cell. And so science ought to be able to say, here is something that's absolutely amazing, that cannot be described in any other way, and it's reasonable to run in the direction of evidence and to think, yeah, you know what? Here we have something that cannot be explained naturally that must have a divine hand in it. I was talking to Heidi earlier. There's a massive discontinuity between you and I and the animals. A massive discontinuity. Read Raymond Tallis, The Aping of Mankind. So when I see the difference between the highest of the great apes and human beings, I'm right to be, as a scientist, to say, there's something in here that I can't understand by natural means. Some God has made us in the image of himself. And so maybe there's this gentle rise between, if you compare some of the animals, and then when we come to us, there's a step discontinuity between us and all the animals. It's right for a scientist to say, how come? I mean, we were talking, Heidi, earlier tonight about feeding behavior. So compare the feeding behavior of your cleverest apes to our feeding behavior. What do you do when you produce a meal? You find out what your friends like to eat. You go shopping. You gather all the herbs together. You spend time cooking it in a special way. You put a nice cover on the table. You might put a candle there. That's incredibly complicated, isn't it? Compared to the highest method of feeding of any animal. Compare human sexuality, if you want. Radically different and radically more wonderful. In every single area of human endeavor in which we are, we are radically distinguished. So as a scientist, I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, step function? I'm right to say, I don't think there's any natural explanation for that. I'm right to say, I think there's another explanation. There's an incredible God who made us distinctly different. Made on the same day, sixth day. This is a lot in common. But actually, we are made in the image of God. How wonderful we are compared to the greatest. And I'm not decrying the apes, Heidi. I'm just saying, by contrast, we are incredibly majestic. Made in the image of God. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. And then the psalmist goes, says, what is man that you are mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him. God has made us, and yet, and we're so small, and yet he loves us and cares for us. Any other questions?
How do we respond to the very common fear we also often new atheists that we just take the divine to explain what we don't know yet.
Yes.
So in hundreds of years we will know much more about our world, and yeah. the divine part shrinks and God is reduced.
Okay, so God are the gaps. So science is kind of filling up our knowledge over the years, and eventually the things that we don't understand will be understood. So take that one I've just said. Here are our apes with a certain level of ability, and we are way up here. One day, science will be able to explain the difference between the two. Is that what that's what you're saying? Yeah, that's what you're saying. How do I respond to that? I respond to it two ways. I think as Christians, we access knowledge in two ways. Not only through reason and experience, we access knowledge through faith. By faith, we believe that God created the heavens and the earth. Is that right? By faith, we believe that? Hebrews 11 somewhere? Who can help me out? Okay? I believe things by faith, and it gives me access to knowledge that I can never derive by experience or human reason. So I believe God is the great creator of all things. I believe I'm made in God's image. And I don't think that will ever alter whatever the findings of science in the future. So I have access to knowledge. I believe there is a heaven. I have no access to heaven by reason or experiment, do I? No access to that. I believe in life after death. I have no access to that knowledge. And that will, unless you believe in some of those near-death experiences, I have no access. In the gospel, we have access to knowledge that is divine and supernatural. I don't know if I've answered your question, Stefan. Have I? The other thing I would say, Stefan, is I believe some of these are category distinctions rather than knowledge distinctions. I cannot ever see anyone showing me that the cleverest chimp and the distinction between us and them is bridgeable. I can never foresee that. It's a category distinction. It's not an acquisition of more knowledge. Heidi will spend the rest of her life maybe discovering wonderful things about the bonobos. But I don't think she'll ever discover that they are doing music in the forest. They have developed maths. They are having parties. They are socializing in the advanced way that we do, putting on discos. And I don't think it ever happened. See, I was offended. I was saying this to Heidi I was offended in 2006. I get National Geographic just as a general thing for our kids, and it had this article, Almost Human. And it was about the bonobos in the Congo. And I was so angry with that article. Because did they go into the forests and did they discover what I've just said? Did they discover those animals with a great orchestra? Did they discover them making fire and cooking their meals and all of them asking for the sausages to be done in different ways? some English, some German style. Did they discover muse? Did they? No, they didn't. And they discovered some very interesting things, but those interesting things were like, sorry, they were way down there. One monkey was carrying a stick around. And so they thought, well, maybe she thinks it's a doll. She's carrying it down. This baby one was carrying a stick around. Maybe she thinks it's a doll. We don't know. So I was really angry with that. So I think some of them are category distinctions, which I don't think will ever. I think they're impossible to bridge. They're category distinctions. I don't know if that's helpful, Stefan. But any other questions?
Touched on the Scopes trial, and there's a lot of animosity. So that's the whole science and faith in terms of origins, creationism, evolutionism.
Yeah, yeah.
How do we approach that in a helpful way? Or what?
I think, Peter, in your situation in America, the reason there is some antagonism between Christian evangelicals and science is because some of science has bought into naturalism. In other words, they are saying that there is no God. Now, if you're an evangelical Christian, you see red when you say there is no God. And yet, as I've said earlier, naturalism has no role in proper science. So part of the key is to kind of clear away that barnacle of naturalism, clear away the barnacle of scientism, and to show actually that's not true science. I think that's one key. Another key, I do think, is to allow Christians to have, now I might be saying something controversial here, to not press one another's consciences on debatable issues. Okay? Some Bible-believing Christians genuinely believe that evolution is the method by which God designed us. Now, I don't personally buy into that. Am I saying something controversial here, Martin?
No,
okay. Say what I like. So some Christians, Dennis Alexander, he's at Cambridge University, and he genuinely believes, and I have no reason to doubt, his sincerity as a born-again, he believes in evangelical Christian. He goes to Eden Baptist Church. Great church. So he would say that at some point in evolutionary history, God intervened and took one great ape and kind of turned him into the first Adam and Eve. Okay. Now, other Christians, particularly in the States, you know, would by and large in the States, would completely reject that and would reject evolutionary theory as a whole. I think Christians need to be able to agree to disagree on issues of secondary importance. And I'll tell you why. When you look, Genesis 1 to 3, at the things we ought to be agreeing on, they are things like this. We are dualists, not... what's the opposite of dualists? Only believes in one in matter. Materialists. Okay, what does Genesis 1 to 3 say? There is a God. The world we live in isn't just what you can touch and see. In the beginning, God. Those first three chapters say that God created man and woman equally and yet with different roles. Am I stepping on something else here? Okay. That's really important. In the beginning, in Genesis 1, male and female, there's a total equality in God's eyes. There's no ontological difference between men and women. But you get to Genesis chapter 2 and you discover Adam is made first. And you discover that God gives his word to Adam, and you discover that Eve is created out of Adam and for Adam, and there's complementarism, and so that's a vital doctrine that comes out of Genesis 1 to 3. Number 3, the world is wired heterosexually. God created Adam and Eve. So we live in a fallen world where we're messed up sexually, but we must see that homosexuality comes after Genesis 3. Not as God created it. Okay? So can you see these fantastic truths that come out of Genesis 1 to 3, which are actually really important for the present world? And sometimes I see Christians disputing over what I personally believe are secondary doctrines and forgetting some of the really big stuff that comes out of Genesis 1 to 3, in which we totally agree. Another one is that we're fallen creatures, Genesis 3. We rebelled against God, and why is the world in the terrible state it's in? It's because of Genesis 3. So these chapters teach us incredibly wonderful things. I don't think we have answers to a lot of the detailed questions. I won't tell you which view I once held. I once held very strongly to one view. And this is why you must never write a book until you've had a lot of thinking. Except for our dear friend who's translating. Her books are wonderful. She's written them. still on sale. but you see, I used to hold one particular view very strongly, and I'll tell you why I held that view strongly. I never explored honestly the other view. But as a Christian, over the last 3 decades, I've looked at try to look at all sides of the view, or all sides of the debate. And this is what you happen. You have camps, don't you? Polarized. And they'll never talk to them, and they'll write books against them, and they'll write books against them. But actually, when you explore that, you discover that actually those two groups are much closer together on the fundamentals than they really think they are. And maybe they need to just give each other, you know, it's a doctrine that's kind of lost. We need to give one another the freedom of conscience to believe things on disputable issues and not fall out with each other. I know of churches where if you're not a creationist, virtually you would be kicked out. So you would be regarded as denying the fundamentals of the gospel. If you did not believe that God created the universe 6,000 years ago in 6 days, you would be kicked out. And there may be churches where if you don't believe in evolutionary theory, 4.3 billion, 13.7 billion, you'd be kicked out as well. I don't know, but there could be. I think Christians ought to be able to agree to disagree, and so I can't quite see it that way. But look, we're absolutely agreed on the fundamentals of the faith. Let's have a discussion, but let's not fight. Another long-winded answer. Yes, it is.